Hello, welcome to the Bechtu Western Freelance podcast. This podcast is given by Films of 59 in Bristol. It's introduced and presented by Dave Ride, Gordon Lester and Jamie Smith. And they discuss Red One and 3D. The 3D is using a new Hurricane rig. Many thanks to them and all at Films of 59 for all their help on the trade show day on the 4th of February 2011 at the Arnos Manor Hotel. So all that's left for me to do now is to hand over to Dave Ride from Films to start off this seminar.
Right, everybody. I'd just like to say a massive thank you for showing such a huge interest in this Red Stroke 3D seminar. I'd just like to say I hope everybody's got a glossary. Has everybody got a glossary? Anybody not got a glossary at all? No? Fantastic. Right, also, I'm just going to hand out these sheets here. They're just if you could just sign in with your name, details, company, and whatever. So we're doing the overview. The overview of the Red is Jamie, and then Gord will take over on the 3D rig. Future training workshops. Right, this is why you're going to be filling out these. We will be running future training workshops at Films at 59. As you can see, they're going to be held on the 3D, the XF305, Red, P2, PMW500, and then we're also offering grip training at a later date with Martin Peters. So if you could just fill in these forms, we will be contacting you at some point in the near future with the relevant times. Right, I'm going to hand you over to Jamie now.
Afternoon, everybody. My name's Jamie. Work at Films at 59. Obviously. I'm here to give you a brief rundown on the Red One, and I know a lot of you will know most of it already, but we'll hopefully there'll be a couple of bits that you can pick up. The Red was launched in the autumn of 2007 amongst much media hype and so on. It was created by Jim Jannard, who was the founder of Oakley Sunglasses. Unfortunately, things to start with were a little bit tricky. There was a slow supply for a start. There was a lot of people on waiting lists to get one. They were constantly updating the firmwares and in the camera builds. Some of the builds were unstable and very difficult to work with. But several people persevered with these problems and actually got some fantastic results showing what the Red was truly capable of in the future. Thankfully now we've got the newest build 30 and the Mysterium X sensor. Everything seems to be working a lot better now. It's a very stable and reliable camera on the whole, and it's a very usable camera now as well. It was really a handful to use now previously, but now anybody can use it. One of the key objectives of Red when they first launched the camera was to try and provide a digital alternative to 35mm film cameras. And although people were sceptical to start with, we can see by the uptake that things are really really going well for them now. We've got the next slide is just going to show a couple of examples of recent films that have been shot all on Red. The recently Oscar-nominated Social Network and the upcoming Pirates of the Caribbean film. The Reds also proved very popular with their shorts producers. It's allowed them to really get that 35mm look, but on a much lower budget than they could have expected on a 35mm camera. I'm going to go through some of the technical aspects of the Red now. First of all, the Red uses a 35mm size sensor. It's a 14-megapixel sensor. It's called a 4K sensor. The actual size of the Mysterium X sensor has increased to 4.5K. This additional resolution has been added in the horizontal plane predominantly, giving a new aspect ratio capable of the camera of 2.33:1, which is a fantastic widescreen option, and it's perfect for cinema release. In terms of for TV release, the largest usable aspect ratio is 16:9, and the largest resolution we can get in 16:9 is 4K.
What apologies, your radio mic is starting to die, so I'll cook you another one. It's all right, sound. Waiting for sound, as always. Okay, Keith, two.
Happy? I don't have to start again, do I?
No,
So just to clarify, I'll just briefly explain what 4K means. Everybody bands around 4K, but not everybody might necessarily know what it means. 4K is 4,000 horizontal pixels of resolution. So every single line of the camera has 4,000 pixels. As I say, on the Mysterium X, it goes up to 4,500 pixels now, but that's only for this particular widescreen aspect ratio. I've got this slide up here now just to briefly demonstrate the sheer scale of the sensor. A lot of the productions that we shoot in and around Bristol use a 2/3-inch sensor, which is this blue box here. And as you can see, the white box on the outside is a representation of the relative size of a 4K sensor compared to the 2/3-inch. And you can see there's a considerable difference. This larger frame size also gives you the, as well as the extra resolution that it's capable of, it gives. This is what creates the 35mm look. By the large sensor gives you the same depth of field as you'd expect to see in a 35mm camera. And the extra resolution allows you to blow up to the big screen without any degradation. The sensor can also be windowed and used in other sizes, and there's several advantages to this. The sensor actually does shut down its usable area and reduce the size of the sensor. There's no compression going on to just reduce it in size or anything like that. And you've got a 3K mode and a 2K mode. Some of the advantages of 2K that we could have a look at. First of all, the lower resolution reduces your file size. This can, if you're shooting a documentary, for example, and you really are churning out quite a lot of material each day, it could be very difficult for you to manage at 4K, just for the sheer volume of media that you're going to shoot. This will also help keep the storage costs down, particularly when you get back to your post facility or whatever. You're going to be paying a lot of money to keep all this media on accessible storage, and shooting at 2K will reduce the need for that. It's also quicker to process the files when they're smaller, so you can get up and running quicker. And then one of the other advantages that I was going to mention, which is particularly applicable in Bristol with the Natural History Unit, is that the reduced size of the sensor effectively more than doubles the focal length of the lens. In fact, it multiplies it by 3.4 times. So for those natural history filmmakers out there, you can take a 185mm prime out and it will give you a 600mm frame at 2K. So it's not, although it's pretty heavy and slightly unwieldy, it's not necessarily a no-go for natural history filmmakers. Another advantage for the natural history filmmakers is the variable frame rate options that the camera has. And at 2K, you can actually get 100 frames per second out of the camera, and in 16:9, it's capable of 120, but that's in a different aspect ratio. And so at 16:9, you can get 100 frames per second. So we're talking about a camera that's got a higher resolution than a Varicam, and is capable of a higher frame rate than a Varicam. So it really does have some plus points for the natural history world. I'm going to move on to have a brief chat about the new MX sensor. It's a significant improvement on the original sensor. Its main advantage is being that they've improved the dynamic range considerably by about two stops. We've now got a dynamic range of the camera of around 13 stops. Well, it's actually rated 13 plus. And the dynamic range of most film stocks is between 12 and 13, so we really have got a lot of movement and flexibility within our dynamic range. This image I've got up, I hope you can all see it all right, is just a still frame taken from the Mysterium X. And if you're up close, it might be difficult from a distance, but there's an incredible amount of detail in the shadows there, and yet we've still got the colour of the sky, all that highlights in the background. It's a really impressive still if you look at it on a nice and close on a big screen. The sensor is also more sensitive. It's been rated as an 800 ASA as opposed to a 320 so it's better in lower light situations as well. This increased dynamic range is particularly useful. It allows you to shoot most subjects and still have headroom in your highlights and headroom in your lowlights. It's fantastic when you come into post-production and to the grade. There's room to manoeuvre for the graders, and it makes a real difference to them. So I've talked about quite a bit about how much this is now like a film camera, but there is of course one key difference, and that's the media. The Red's got a couple of options. It's actually got three options. I've got the two most common ones up here for removable storage. We've got the Red drives, which come in at 640 gig, is the largest one that they've got on the market at the moment, and that can run for over 5 hours at 4K. So if you are shooting a documentary where you don't have a lot of time with being able to download your rushes throughout the day and that kind of thing, if you've got one or two of those, you should be able to get a day's worth of media pretty easily. And then we've got the compact flash cards as well, which is 16 gig in size on the bigger option, and that gives you around 8 minutes at 4K. Both of these options have got their advantages and disadvantages. Obviously, the Red drive's main advantage is its sheer size, but it has been known to drop frames because it is unfortunately a moving drive, and if there's a lot of movement whilst you're filming, if you're handheld or in a vehicle or something like that, there's a potential to drop a frame here or there. If you're using the compact flash cards, they're much more stable. There's no moving parts in there. You should be absolutely fine with the compact flash cards. Just a brief chat about the file format. So the Red shoots RAW, similar to a DSLR and so on. It's not a true RAW because it does actually compress its file before it gets to its card to a degree, but they call it a RAW. The main reason they call it a RAW is that it really is shot as is seen, and there's nothing applied to it until it gets into post-production. This really does give the graders and so on the maximum flexibility possible, and a lot of people have really enjoyed how much they can manipulate the image towards the end of the process. Some people find it difficult looking at such a flat image while they're shooting, but in the long run, it's well worth it. So any changes that you do make in camera, such as your white balance, or if you're adding in any gain or anything like that, these are all actually just attached to the RAW file as metadata. When you load it into your software, the metadata is read, but it can be manipulated just as easily as it was read in the first place. So if the colour temperature is off, that can be corrected just with a click of a mouse, basically. The second section of this slide explains the different quality levels, is what the Red calls it. These are different rates of compression. We've got Red code 28, 36, and 42. Those figures are quoted in megabytes per second, but for every other camera that we've talked about for the last few days, it's always in megabits per second. It's a simple conversion from one to the other. There's 8 bits in the byte, so you times it by 8 and you get the true figure just to relate it to every other camera that you're using. So they're listed here. The most common one to use is 36, Red code 36, which is a 288 megabits per second codec. The next stage I wanted to talk about was media management. When you're creating this amount of digital media, and it's so important, it has to be looked after properly. And unfortunately, in some cases, this is an area that gets neglected. It gets left to an overtired camera operator at the end of the day to be doing it between meals and between going to bed and all that kind of thing. It's really worth investing in a well-trained, qualified, whatever, DIT to be looking after your media. At the end of the day, this is the most important bit of the shoot, and unfortunately, sometimes it seems to get neglected. A good quality DIT will not just be able to copy all your files for you. A good DIT will have good experience with the camera and can help with setups of the camera and that kind of thing. They'll be able to review the rushes, even if it's a frame at a time, because it's difficult to get proper playback out in the field. But they will be able to look at the rushes and be able to spot any potential issues within the picture. If, for example, the camera hasn't had a black balance for ages and they start to see some problems in the blacks, they can, a well-trained DIT will be able to alert the crew that that's the case, and rather than just continuing through the whole shoot, shooting the same thing. So investment in a DIT is money well spent. This is basically all they need, a laptop with the RED software on, a couple of drives, some card readers, and a cup of coffee by the looks of it. Okay, as with all cameras, there's a few things that can trip you up. Thankfully, there's less and less of them now as the builds develop. First of all, you'd need to follow all your normal working practices that you would use on any other camera. Black balance is an essential thing to be doing fairly regularly. Checking your back focus, all that kind of stuff. It doesn't get neglected just on the RED. A few things to look out for. In the newer builds, they've introduced some variables in the look menu that can actually, if you get it wrong, they can actually make a permanent alteration to your RAW file, and they are non-removable later. So I've just put the main areas of the look table in here, but if you're not confident with what you've got in the look menus and what they're going to do, I would recommend leaving the factory presets until you've done some experimenting and you really know what's going on. The items that could potentially cause you a problem are FLUT, which is floating point lookup table, color space, and gamma. Just finally, a quick chat about the potential competition for the RED. There's a few cameras out there, but these are the two primary competition. The Sony F35 is a 35mm sensor. It records at 800 meg per second onto SR tapes, and it looks like a very good camera, but it's still only a 1080 sensor. So it doesn't particularly lend itself that well to being stretched out to the big screen. So if you're ever planning on putting anything onto a cinema screen, the lower resolution of the F35 potentially limits its possibilities. The Arri Alexa is following suit with the RED with a large framed, high resolution sensor, several different recording formats, and I think this is the first true competition that the RED's had in its field coming through now, and we'll have to wait and see how well it competes against the RED in the next few months. That's about it, and we've got a brief 5 minutes for any questions if anybody's got any.
What's the price difference between the RED and the new Arri?
You could probably buy 2.5 RED's for 1 Arri.
Is it about that?
Yeah.
So what's that, 20 or 50?
I think it's a $21,000 with a new sensor.
Yeah, the RED and the Arri is coming in at the moment. It's 50,000 euros for the base package. Euros, yeah. By the time you add all the other bits.
It's actually only seen in camera. You've got two viewing options in the RED. You can view RED RAW or RED Code. The RED Code actually does a process just on the output, on the all the video feeds. It effectively applies a very light grade, and it puts on any of the information that you have programmed in, light, color, temperature, or whatever, and gain. It will put it onto that feed. But if you're looking at RED RAW, you can change the colour temperature all you like and you won't see anything because it's not actually affecting the RAW file.
You were mentioning with the two different storage mediums that with the drive you can get drop frames in extreme situations. I just wanted to know if there's any sort of buffer within the camera or even within the drive as it is.
No.
No.
Quite simply. Yeah. So that's why it's so important. I mean, our drives are actually in an elasticated caddy just to reduce it even more, but it is a potential risk, and you have to assess each shot and really think, do I need a CF card for this? There is the third option I didn't talk about is replaces the compact flash card slot on the side and gives you a solid state slot in option. they're fairly new onto the market. They're going to be in the Epic. They look brilliant. They're much higher. They're 128 or 256 gigabyte, but they are $1,500.
$1,503, $3,100
respectively. So they are dear. Whereas the compact flash cards are $100 for five, I think.
But they had a red RAM as well that was out, which was like
which is a solid state drive as well. Yeah, but they've stopped making.
Yeah, but so is the drives. They discontinued as well. They're not on their site with the 640 gigs.
Oh right, okay, yeah, because they're basically they're moving over to the SSDs. Yeah,
because
yeah.
If you use them at a pop concert, they just drop like mad.
Yeah,
absolutely. Any vibration, they will drop.
The Epics? That's a good question.
Who's got one? I don't know. Well, to the final with Red, they got first one in.
Oh, yeah, of course he's got one.
Peter Jackson's using them on the new Shooting the Hobbit. Mm. I think he's testing them, really.
It's going to be a bit of a waiting game again, unfortunately. This is how Red do things. I mean, Dave was saying earlier, we ordered two viewfinders for our Reds a year ago when we bought them, and we still haven't had the viewfinders, so we're at the top of the list, though.
Along with everybody else.
Yeah, you're at the top of the list. They've got it on an answer phone message. Any other questions? That's great. Well, thanks a lot for your time and listening. And I'm going to hand over to Gordon, and he's going to talk to you about 3D.
That's brilliant, Jamie. Well done. My laser pointer. I want my laser pointer. Good afternoon, everybody, or maybe good evening. My name's Gordon Lester. I'm going to give you a 3D overview. It's going to be fairly basic. One thing I want to point out before we started was, because we've got to touch on quite a lot of things. If you've got any questions, if we could keep them to the end, would be really good. But having said that, if there is there a point where you really don't understand one of the stages that I've gone through, just put your hand up and we could go over it again. But we've just got quite a lot to go through. So, first question: hands up, who has a 3D TV at home? Tough crowd then. There we go, there's one. Okay, well, the reason I asked that question is I really wanted to start by going back probably 30 years in terms of looking at the history of 3D, because certainly my recollection of a 3D movie 30 years ago is probably Jaws 3D, and from what I can remember of it when I was 10 or 12, it was pretty rubbish. So some of you may be asking, why 3D? Why 3D again? Is it really going to be any better than the last time? And I think, well, I'm convinced actually the answer to that question is yes. And the reason for that is, back 30 years ago when Jaws 3D was made, although they did a very good job with the tools and the technology that they had to make a 3D film, we've now advanced 30 years, and basically technology has advanced so much that we're able to make a really good 3D film. So the cameras are much better, the rigs are really good. We've got post-production tools that can correct any alignment issues that we're going to have inevitably. No matter how well the 3D rigs are set up, there is going to be something that kind of goes out. And in terms of post-production tools that we've got available to us today, we can definitely deal with those, and we can bring to the screen a really good 3D film. The other thing that was a problem back then with, say, Jaws 3D was that the projectors weren't brilliant, very well lined up, whereas now we've got perfectly calibrated 3D digital projectors, and that makes a really big difference. I don't know if you've anybody have you actually been to the cinema and watched any 3D films in the cinema recently. What I've seen recently, they've been really good. So I think that's the reason why this time round, 3D is probably here to stay. Okay. The other thing that's happening, is as well as everything that's going on in terms of 3D feature filmmaking, we've got the consumer market is really driving 3D. So we've got 3D TVs, we've got domestic 3D cameras, and that's really, really pushing things along and making the concept of 3D much more accessible, and another reason why I think it probably this time around won't go away. Okay. Sky 3D. Sky have got a 3D channel, HD channel. They do movies, sport, documentaries, music, dance. And the other area is gaming, something that we've not seen a lot of so far. But I think 3D games in terms of... computer games generally are an immersive product, so the ability to immerse yourself in another dimension into a game, I think, is probably going to be very popular when they start coming out properly. You've got your 3D glossaries. Listed are, this is some of the subjects that we're going to go through today on the glossary. We're going to try and keep it as basic as possible, but really that's quite a contradiction. I think basic 3D is a contradiction, so we'll run through them. So do you want to put those up, John? Anaglyph. All right. So there's three different types of glasses that we're going to see. Anaglyph, you probably recognise those, the old red and blue glasses. Polarised and active glasses. They all do the same thing, basically. They block out the image from one eye and then the other eye alternately, so we can basically see a 3D image. Thanks, Jamie. Z-axes. Interocular, probably one of the most important things that we're going to talk about today. Parallax and convergence. Depth budget and roundness. Okay. Excuse me, I'll try and finish this mint. Sorry about that. You get the crunches amplified, sorry. I really didn't think about that. Okay, so we got a 2D image. And this may sound a bit of an obvious thing to say, but a 2D image has two axes, a Y-axis and an X-axis, two dimensions, basically. With a 3D image, you can see we've got this additional axis, which is the Z-axis. This is really important because it's our Z-axis. It's also our third dimension. And so if you imagine our 3D space is going to travel along this Z-axis, and that's really in and out of the screen towards the viewer and away from the viewer. So if you can kind of hold that idea. Another angle of that Z-axis. I put this one in because it really clearly shows that we've got our screen here, and we've got our guy in his car. He's basically travelling along the Z-axis out of the screen and into the screen. Our 3D depth, which is... if you can go back to the other slide, John, because I think I've gone on a little bit too quick there. Okay. The concept of 3D is to have an amount of depth which comes out of the screen towards the viewer and also goes into the screen away from the viewer. And this comes out, you know, this travels along the Z-axis. So if you can kind of picture a 3D depth space that we created with our camera interocular distance, and this amount of 3D depth is fixed in this position, and it can travel along the Z-axis, so it can kind of come... Oh, due to some power, John. Well, that's on a socket. Okay, so... Try and visualise an area of 3D space. If you've seen a 3D movie, you can see that stuff comes out of the screen towards you and goes away. So visualise that space. It's travelling along the Z-axis. Next slide, please. Okay, so how do we create this amount of 3D depth or 3D box? We move the cameras apart, which is along our interocular distance. So as we pull the cameras apart, we create our 3D depth. Okay? Right, convergence point. I wasn't overly happy about this slide, so I was going to, if I can get some assistance in terms of explaining it with people and objects, that would be really useful, because it's not that clear on the slide, so I hope that's okay. So what I wanted to explain that was we've got two camera positions, and we've got a convergence point. The convergence point is the screen, effectively. And objects that are in the negative parallax, which we'll go on to in a moment, come out of the screen. And objects which are in the positive parallax will go into the screen in 3D. So if what I really need is a foreground object, a middle object, and then a tree at the back.
Thanks.
Okay, so
somewhere at the back.
Yeah. So I'm actually going to, because the camera angles are going to go this way, you guys are facing this way, it'll hopefully make more sense. If it doesn't, just say, I don't know what you're talking about, and I'll try and explain it a different way. So Jack is my foreground object. If you could stand there, Jack. Jamie is my convergence point, or my screen, effectively. And if you turn around this way as well. And Dave is my tree in the background. Okay, so I've got my pair of cameras, and I'm basically going to converge them. Actually, probably if you come down a little bit, if you can. I'm going to converge them on Jamie in the middle. So if you imagine two camera positions, they're going to start to come together or converge on Jamie. Okay. Now, at that point, there's no 3D in the picture. The convergence point, there's zero 3D. In front of that point, or coming out of the screen where Jack's standing, there is 3D. So we've got two Jacks, effectively, here, you'll see. When I put my glasses on, they will fuse the image, and Jack will appear to come out of the screen. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. So where Jamie's stood is the convergence point. There's no 3D. But behind him, and he's also the screen plane, behind him, Dave is a big tall tree. past Jamie, there will be some, there's a 3D depth effect, but it's going away from the screen, it's going into the screen, okay? And this is quite important because this is convergence, and I was hoping it would make sense in this way rather than the diagram, because it's quite a difficult thing to explain. So it's better with your hands. So two camera positions. They cross over. The point they cross over is Jamie. He's the screen. 3D comes out of the screen in the negative space, and past Jamie is the positive space, goes into the scene. Did everybody get that? There's a bit more to it as we go on, and hopefully it will kind of drop into place. So thank you. We've got no power. I'll have to just make it up now, I reckon. So hold the while they're sorting that out, hold the thought of camera convergence. We've created this amount of 3D space with our interocular. We've set the 3D space, and it's going to travel on the Z-axis in and out of the screen. And we, at some point, we're going to decide what's going to come out of the screen. We can choose what's going to come out of the screen by what amount, by converging the cameras at a certain point. So where we converge the cameras becomes the screen plane. Anything in front of that point comes out of the screen, and everything past that goes in. And that's the basic principle of 3D space and convergence. Do you want to ask questions while we're doing that? Because
so what you're saying then, basically, you would have to block the action to make it 3D.
To block the action to make it 3D.
Say, well, you know, he's going to have to stand here in order for it to, you know, for it to play 3D. Would that be why you say the Clash of the Titans kind of 3D after effect didn't quite work? Because it was shot for that?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah, I've not seen it, but I know that they've basically arrived at 3D from 2D, and generally speaking, that doesn't work. Sorry.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's probably why. And the reason, yeah, what they've tried to do in Clash of the Titans is they've had a single camera position, and they've just introduced another one virtually. But the whole point of 3D, we all see in 3D. We're looking at each other in 3D right now. You know, we've got two cameras, two eyes. There's a stereo calculation going on in our brain, and we can see depth. But it relies on the fact that there's a distance between our eyes, and that's parallax. So one thing we could do if we don't fully understand parallax is if you hold your hold a finger out in front of you and alternately close your left and right eye, your finger jumps from one position to another. That's parallax. So that's the principle of 3D. Okay. Next slide, please. Okay, so we've already touched on the fact that at this convergence point of the screen, anything that appears in front from this point, anything that appears in front of the screen, and then anything that appears behind the screen will go into the distance or come out towards the viewer. and this is parallax, which we've just touched on. So parallax is the distance the left and the right eye images on screen without glasses, known as parallax. And the reason we've said without glasses is because they appear to be two separate images until we put our 3D glasses on, whether they're polarized or whatever. That the effect of putting the glasses on fuses the images together, and then they appear to be coming out of the screen or going into the screen, and that's parallax. Negative parallax is in front of the screen, so everything in the negative parallax will come out of the screen towards you. Zero parallax is the point where we've crossed the cameras over, our convergence point, and it's the screen plane. And positive parallax is behind that point going into the screen. It still looks like 3D. It still looks like, it still gives you the perception of depth, but it's going away from you. Where would you want to position it? Well, that depends really on, there are a number of things that you need to be a little bit careful with. Fast movement doesn't work very well with 3D. So if you've got an action scene going on, you've converged on that scene, if arms are flying around or guns are going off and rockets are flying around, those are potentially going to come straight out of the screen towards the viewer. If you want that to happen, then of course you would, and the object is travelling in that direction, then you would converge on that point. But
I think the Sky specs do say that they advise your point of interest is your convergence point.
It depends what it is.
Your cameras on your zero parallax point when you're setting up your scene.
Yes, I do. I focus that when I set the thing up, I'll set it on the point of convergence. So I don't know who anyone's seen Avatar in 3D. The cinema, right? Apparently, everything James Cameron's going to do from now on is going to be 3D. So he's really got the bug. But one of his techniques that he employed in that, I've only seen it in 2D, so I can't really comment that much. But he links his convergence point to his focus point. So I don't know, what did it look like?
Yeah,
did it work?
It's really interesting actually, because it doesn't do a lot of stuff in the negative space. You know what I mean?
Okay. That comes out the screen. Yeah. Okay.
But there are bits where the keying into the focus doesn't work. There's a bit I only remember one bit, but you've got something that's very big in foreground and coming out the screen in foreground, and it's completely softened out of focus, and the actor sat behind it.
That's quite by accident. That's actually quite good, because you've got this object that's quite big. And if it's coming out of the screen to you at that sort of size, it's probably going to have very large parallax.
Right.
And what I mean by that is, as it comes towards you, you've got so much 3D effect in there, and it's come out of the screen at you so much, the distance between the two images is too big for you to fuse, and there's a limit to what you can do. So that's called on-screen divergence, basically. Divergence just means... As you're sat looking at me at the moment, your eyes are quite comfortable just looking straight at me, and eventually, if you were looking into the distance, they would just converge to infinity. Your eye muscles are relaxed in that position. If you present them with an image or a set of images on the screen that you need to fuse to create a 3D image, which are very far apart, your brain is going to try and diverge your eyes to try and pull them back together, and that hurts. It's uncomfortable. So, but anyway, what I was going to say with that, I kind of waffled a bit, was by that subject that's come out of the screen too far being out of focus, it doesn't bother us as much because we see it as a defocused object, and we move on, and there's probably a very quick cut at that point as well in terms of the edit. While we're talking about defocused shots, it's important to remember or to mention that one of the techniques our brain uses to fuse two images to create 3D is texture, and they're called depth cues. So if something's got texture, we can pretty much figure out what it is, where it is, and all sorts of different things. We can compute that information. If it's defocused or blurred, it has no texture, and it has no real meaning in terms of 3D space, so we don't really know what to do with it. If it was on the screen for long enough, it would probably annoy you. Yeah. Okay. This is an anaglyph of some cactus, as you can see, and it's a really good... we've just talked about parallax and convergence, and I think this is a really good shot to explain what we were talking about in terms of our negative parallax, zero parallax, and positive parallax. So as long as I'm not in anyone's way... So at this point here, we've got negative parallax. We've got this cactus in the foreground. There's a distance between the two. You can see the two images there. That, if we were to fuse that with a pair of anaglyph glasses, that cactus would come out of the screen towards us. Okay. Now just below it, where we've got our zero parallax point, this is where our cameras have crossed over. This was Jack earlier on when I was explaining convergence. At that point there, you'll just see that as a cactus. It won't really look anything more than that, and it'll look fairly 2D. And then beyond that, you can see everything else, including this area that's been arrowed as positive parallax, is going away from us into the distance, but it still has a 3D depth to it. Okay, the sum at the bottom of the screen is positive parallax plus negative parallax equals our depth budget. And we'll move on in a moment to what our depth budget is, but if you can kind of hold that thought that those two figures combined are our depth budget, that's what we can, the area that we can work in total. So to summarise, IO, the distance the cameras are apart, is our 3D volume control. Okay, we turn it up, we make the cameras come apart, our 3D volume grows and becomes bigger, we close it down, it shrinks. Convergence point is at the screen plane. Everything in front of the screen has a negative parallax or comes out towards you. And everything behind the screen has a positive parallax and goes away from you. I personally think those terms are the wrong way around. And I don't yet know why they are that way, but I'd expect it to be the other way around. I don't know if you agree. Anyway. Depth budget. Okay, so as I've mentioned, positive parallax plus negative parallax, depth total budget. Depth budget is a measurement of 3D depth, and it's controlled by the interocular, the distance the cameras are apart. Cannot be changed in post-production. If we hang on that for a moment, that's really important. So we pull our cameras apart for whatever the shot is, and we've set our interocular distance of 40 millimetres for argument's sake, which has created as a depth box of this size. We can, with our camera convergence, the towing in of the camera, we can decide where on the Z-axis that 3D space will exist. So we can, depending on where we converge, that's the screen plane, we can move it around, we can have stuff coming out of the screen, or we can have it going back in, we can have it half and half, it's really up to you. What we can't do is change that amount of 3D we've got. I'm talking in post-production terms now. So once we've set it, we give ourselves a big IO, or a big depth. We can't do anything else in post-production with that. We're stuck with that. And it's measured in as a percentage of screen width. Okay, so how do we measure this amount? The next slide will explain that we get given by Sky, for example, a depth budget that we have to work in. Theirs is 3%. So they're telling us that we can, they would prefer, we have a total overall budget of 3%. We can kind of do what we like with it, but they prefer 1% coming out of the screen towards us because it's probably playing it safe, I guess. And the other 2% going the other way, so going into the screen. So how are we going to, how are we going to calculate this amount? A 1920 1080 picture, or 2K, I mean, it's not technically 2K, but we'll call it 2K for now. 1% of that, and we measure the parallax on screen, is 20 pixels. So can we go back to the parallax slide? The anaglyph, sorry. Yeah. So if I needed to work out how much parallax I could have in the background, let's just say this distance here is 2%, for argument's sake. I would measure that in pixels. So 20 pixels is 1%. So that let's just say that gap there is 40 pixels wide. And I can measure that with my setting up monitor. I can measure it with a ruler. And then I'll measure this point at the front there, and hopefully, let's just say for argument's sake, that happens to be 1%. Okay, so it's 20 pixels. I combine those two together, and that gives me my overall depth budget. So we can actually measure those on screen. And then at least if we go over that and we have excessive parallaxes, which are going to cause us problems, not just from comfort of the viewer, but Sky Sports, for example, are probably going to technically fail that material because it's got too much 3D in it. Just go to roundness now. Okay, so hopefully I've kind of got everybody at the moment. I've not really lost anybody. Does somebody want to hold this ball up for me? Again, this is seems a slightly unusual term. You want to come out sort of there? Thanks. And something that I can really only explain with the help of a ball and Jamie. Yeah, if you maybe just sort of stand next to me. I'm just going to gesticulate around the ball. So the term 3D roundness or roundness in an image or 3D depth, you will hear stereographers describing what they've managed to achieve with their 3D depth as good roundness. And really, the real reason for that, I think, is that if I'm looking at Jamie, for example, at the moment, I can see that he is, he's got a round face. He's got an ear on either side of his head, and I can see, I can almost see around him. So if I've got a reasonable IO with my cameras, I've pulled my camera positions out, and I'm using a pair of wide-angle lenses. I can see more of him. Okay, does that make sense? Because I can see more of him, I can tell that he's a three-dimensional object, a bit like this ball. I almost don't need the ball now, do I? So I can. A good roundness means good 3D, because really, good 3D is about creating depth in an image. And if I to go the other way, the other extreme, if I was to shoot this ball with a narrow interocular, so I've got my cameras quite close together, I'm also using more of a telephoto focal length. Telephoto lenses compress depth. So if I was to shoot that with something like, 100 mil or something, the ball would appear to be flat to me. And if it's flat, it's not 3D. It's got no depth. So a good wide-angle lens and a reasonable interocular distance is going to give me roundness in my images, and it's going to make for good 3D, basically. Does that make sense to everybody? Bit of an odd term, but I think it works to describe what. Yeah, yeah. Right. Exactly. If you look in your, exactly. That's exactly what it is, Steve. So if you look in your glossary, there's actually a section or there's a term called cardboard cutout effect, I think it is in there. And that's exactly what it is. I think those type of long-range sports are quite difficult to do because you can't do it with a wide-angle lens. You could have a wide interocular and you could have your cameras on a side-by-side rig and have them, this distance apart. You'll see that configuration for those type of sports shooting. But if the football pitch is, however far it is away, 150 yards or whatever, I've got to use a telephoto lens, so I'm a little bit screwed there. So it will have that effect. It will make stuff. There'll be an effect of depth there, but there'll be little or no roundness. So they do, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. They are. Yeah. They have that. Do you remember the old 3D viewers? That's got that cardboard cutout effect. I mean, it's the same principle of fusing the same image together, but it's quite crude, so it gives you that effect.
Can you have too much roundness?
Can you have too much roundness? You probably could, yeah, because if you want to print somebody's face in a film, you want them to look how they really look. So if you go over the top, you'll start to make them look more round than they should be. It's quite easy to see with spherical objects as well. If you look, the big thing about 3D and whether you've got it right or not in terms of the depth is look at it with your eyes, because we all see in 3D. And if what you've managed to get and print looks like what we see, then it's right, basically, you know?
So is there a limit to how wide you should span your camera?
There is a limit, yeah. You'll start to get some effects. If you start to go too wide and you're fairly close, you will have, yeah, you'll get that. And you'll also get miniaturizing effects as well. If you get it wrong, you'll change scale of things. So too big an interocular with a medium-sized zoom will make things look too small from this position. And if you use, it'll have the opposite effect if you use a narrow interocular. So, roundness. So hopefully that demonstrates roundness. Stages. Planning. Camera. Capture. Monitor. Post-production finishing. Okay. Stereographer. Okay, so this is a term, again, it's in your glossary. The stereographer can be anybody on the film crew or whatever you're doing. It doesn't necessarily need to be anyone in particular. It could be the producer, it could be the director. They're, as long as they've got the overall knowledge of what's required to create 3D images, and they know what's going to be a problem, the kind of things that you can't shoot in 3D, then that's their role. And they'll oversee the whole production from start to finish and just make sure that everything keeps on track, basically. Previs. Previsualization. Worth making a note of this website if you're going to be... It's on there, is it? Yeah, okay. What's Previs? So Previs is a piece of software that will run on a laptop or whatever. It outputs at 3D, so you can put some polarized glasses on and you can see this virtual set that you've built. So you can add characters, objects, you can change focal length of the camera, you can change the interocular, you can change the convergence, you can do everything virtually in this 3D set that you've created before you go off and spend a couple of weeks building a set and realize pretty early on that you've made a few mistakes because certain things don't work in 3D. So I think Previs is probably worth its weight in gold. There's another same company make for iPhones and iPads, something called a 3D stereo calculator. So great for 3D tech. They can, with this application, enter in cameras, lenses, again, all the other things that you would want to set up, and it will work out for you. You put your distance of your objects in. It will work out when you're starting to go over with your interocular, when you've got excessive divergence and those types of things. So really, really useful. About £50, I think, on iTunes. Depth budget. Okay, so this is Sky's current 3D depth budget, and as you can see, they're allowing 2% positive into the background and 1% negative. And we have to work within those budgets. And as I explained earlier on, they're there really to prevent us from making something that's got too much on-screen, too much parallax, basically. So it's going to cause on-screen divergence. So images too far apart, we can't fuse them, therefore they cause our eyes to diverge and it's uncomfortable. And if it's not uncomfortable, it's difficult to figure out what's going on.
Yeah. How does that compare with, say, the cinema?
What, the amounts? Yeah, that's a good question. I think you can probably go, on a big screen in the cinema, you can probably go up to 4%. I think Sky at the moment, because they're... they're quite new to the, you know, they've got a channel that's got lots of, they would like to have a lot of 3D content. They're probably playing it a little bit safe, so I think 4% probably. The thing about the screen as well is it's different on a much larger screen. It has a different effect as well where you're sat in the cinema. I think next time you can't really move around while you're in the cinema. You choose where you sit, but. The further there is a sweet spot in the cinema in terms of viewing 3D, and it's generally the width of the screen in meters you away from that point. That's the sweet spot. So you'll kind of crowd around those seats, fight over those seats. What you'll find as well, if you're able to, is as you move towards the back of the cinema and away from the screen, you'll basically stretch out this 3D effect. I've not personally experienced it, but your eyes adjust to most things quite easily, so I don't think it's too much of a problem. File management. Okay, well, Jamie talked about file management. There's nothing really different in terms of those processes. The obvious thing is there's twice as much footage or files or tapes or whatever. You do need to be really careful that you're creating a left eye and a right eye video stream onto tape, onto cards, then you're then going to copy it off onto some external drives. You need to be really clear that you've labelled left and right. It will become fairly obvious in post that somebody switched the eyes over, but they could have wasted quite a lot of time doing that. So I did read a good example of a practice. Somebody was shooting HD Cam SR, I think, on tapes. They had two separate tapes with HD Cam SR. They glued the boxes together and labelled them up. So it was kind of impossible to not give somebody a left and a right eye. So that's quite a good idea, I think. Plan, and plan. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think you can do too much planning, really. The pre-visualization software is definitely a tool that you should be using for that. Camera rigs. So the mirror rig is the rig we've got here, and generally most of the rigs that you're going to see will be this type of configuration. A pair of cameras shooting into the mirror, and they can be anything from these all the way up to Arri Alexas, but they'll all use a similar system of shooting into a mirror. The reason for that is that there's a physical limit. If you've got two cameras, there's a physical limit to how close you can get them together. So with a mirror rig, you're effectively starting at zero because they're looking at the same thing, and then you can gradually adjust that from, you know, from zero up to 10 centimetres. So always use the best mirror that you can. Really briefly about mirrors, because one camera is shooting through the mirror, so it's a glass surface, so we've lost a stop of light already. And then the other camera is shooting the reflectance from that mirror, and that's also lost a stop of light. Because it's a glass surface and it's got a coating on, unless it's the very, very best that you can afford, it will have slight ripples in, and those ripples can distort the image. So mirrors go from £500 up to £10,000. So it's really what you can actually afford. You'll generally see issues with mirrors if you choose to shoot on the longer end of the lens, say 100mm upwards, because you're actually magnifying the surface of the mirror at 100mm, if it's got some defects, you're going to see them, and it's going to affect all of your image, whereas if you're on a wide-angle lens, you're spreading that image across more of the surface area of the mirror. So wide angles are better for mirrors. Side-by-side, better for shooting distant shots, so you can get, this thing does 10 centimetres, and that's probably not enough if you're doing sport. You'd want to come out to, I don't know, maybe a metre if it's distant enough. Golf, maybe, you're going to shoot. Panasonic 3DA1 camera, have we got one in? Yeah, it might be worth it, because I can just explain real quick. Don't worry, I'll explain it, it's fine. So Panasonic 3DA1, we're all familiar with Z1 size cameras, I'm assuming. So it's a small twin lens camera. It records onto onboard cards. It's got a fixed interocular distance of 65mm. So we can converge, but we can't move the interocular. It's set. So it's limited because we're set at 65mm. And as I said earlier, a lot of the stuff I've been doing has been down to about 30mm. So it can do some things really well. It's a small camera you can put out of a bag compared to this, and you can be off and you can shoot some good 3D with it, but it can't do everything. Can't do close-up work. Minimum 3 metres to subject, to nearest. Okay, so this is a really good example of a 3D, very top-end, made by a company called 3ality that are based in Burbank in the States. And this is about as good as it gets. This is a fully adaptive rig. We've got, as you can see there, we've got two Sony HD 1500 camera heads, and that's basically the camera, that's the the head of, say, a F900R or a HDW750. HA22 lens on each one, shooting through a mirror similar to this one, which I'll show you in a moment. Umbilicals coming off the camera, and it's being recorded somewhere in the distance that you can't even see. But that's a huge rig, best part of 100 kilos. So very expensive, £300,000 plus just for the rig. Okay, so this is a list of what we've actually got here on this rig. How are we doing for time? Can we do a... We're okay. What I was going to do, because I'd really like to... this rig, I'm not going to show you a 3D image from the rig, because well, hopefully a lot of you have already seen that earlier on. Oh, great. Okay, thank you. But I did want to point to the key parts of it and what do we do to get our interocular distance and what's the mirror and so on. So I think the best thing to do is I'll start talking about a bit of it. It's on HDMI. Yeah, do it, yeah. Because I think we were just going to magnify the rig on the monitor so you could see it better.
Why is writing and things like that not practical?
Because I've flipped the output on the monitor. Yeah, I can flip. It's quite important, yeah.
You tend to do that in post as well, obviously.
Yeah.
When you go in,
yeah.
You could just flip the right on the
yeah. When I'll mention that in a moment, that's the key thing about some of this kit. It looks fairly standard, but it's got things like the ability to do that in it, so you can get away with that problem. Okay, let's start with the mirror box. So... actually, where am I not in the way? There, can you do both? You all right? Okay. So if you come out, just step back a little bit, Jay. Just assuming you're not... Yeah. Because this is quite... Yeah, and I'm going to come around and move the interocular in a moment. So our lower camera, the EX3, is shooting... That's okay. That's fine. You're right. It's shooting the reflection... from the mirror, okay? The camera on top, the EX1, is shooting through the mirror. It's a half-silvered mirror, so one on the bottom is shooting the reflection, the one on top is shooting through it. So once it's lined up, they're pretty much looking at exactly the same thing. But at the moment, can you see you're seeing two lenses there? That's because I've moved the left eye camera, the top camera, over by an amount, 50mm or something like that. And that's our interocular. That's our adjustment. That's our 3D depth adjustment. And I'm just going to wind it back in. If you stay on there just so we can see it. So if I'm just turning this geared crank here, can you see them moving together? Yeah? And that's why you couldn't do that on any other rig other than the mirror rig, because we're virtually having the cameras aligned due to the reflection. Absolutely, yeah. Now, that's a really good point, actually, that you've brought macro up. I've not done much testing yet, but there's a potential real... Do you want to relax for a second, Wallace? Thanks, Jay. There's a potential real problem with macro 3D. You know, I mentioned earlier on about long lenses. We're magnifying the surface of the mirror one-to-one, basically. So if your mirror isn't the best mirror that you can possibly get your hands on, you may have some problems. And it will be image distortion.
How would macro look? Because there's so much depth, like a shallow depth. Yeah. So what would look 3D there actually? Like
don't know, because I've not really done much testing on it. But it's a good question. I've not really done enough to say. I was going to mention something else about mirrors then, actually. No, it's gone. It'll come back to me later. Okay. Yeah. No, that's okay. Thanks for trying to prompt me. It'll come back. Okay, so that's our mirror box. So if we now come round to... Yeah, I'll just shout over which bits to point at. So have a... Just point at that. Come back towards that little... So that thing that I was turning there, this is the hand wheel I was turning. You can see this camera is sliding along this way by about 10 centimetres from its zero position. And that's the interocular adjustment. basically. To the right of it, there's a little gold, this thing. If I turn that, the camera toes in or converges. So if you imagine I've got, we only need to do it on one camera. You can converge on both cameras, but there's really not much point. So the lower cam, this camera is fixed. And before I've put any convergence in or turn that knob, basically there'll be the cameras are pointing straight ahead. As I turn the knob, the left eye camera converges, and eventually, well, depending on how far I converge it in, they'll cross over at that point.
How will you know what you're converging on when you're looking in the monitor? Do you have to have some software which shows you your convergence?
Yeah, can we? Can I illustrate that? The cactus. Yeah, well, can we go back to the cactus slide? Do you mean how am I going to know where I'm converging?
Yeah, while you're shooting it, how do you know how far to turn that little dial so that you know what you're converging on?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a bit of an advanced stage in terms of showing you how to set the thing up. But I'll show you with the picture. Okay. You know the anaglyph picture of the cactuses.
Yeah,
that's. If we look at a 3D image without glasses on, we can see what's going on. And that's the key to it. Okay, so...
So here we can see the convergences on that, where it says zero parallel.
Absolutely. So the way I would set the camera, the transvideo monitor, which is up there, has got an anaglyph function. So I can look at the output from the camera, and it'll look like this. As I turn the convergence screw to any point, the point that looks 2D and has no overlap is my convergence point. Okay. And beyond that, we've got this. Absolutely. Yeah, it will, yeah. What I've done on this one, this is a true anaglyph. On the monitor, I turn it into mono. So it's basically an anaglyph, but it's mono as well. So when I initially set the rig up, I'm looking for a complete mono image, and that means that at no point anywhere in the image is there an overlap, because if there was an overlap, I'd see this. So that's why that particular monitor is a really effective tool. I can't set that rig up properly without that monitor. Yeah, I can toggle between my SDI 1 and 2 on my left and right eye to just check that they're exposed, focused, and that they're set up and white balanced. Yeah, and then I'll look at my 3D view, which is a combination of both. What else is on that rig that we can talk about? The 3D Nano. So that the thing with all the spaghetti coming out of it, I could record on board onto these cards on the cameras. Sorry.
Just quickly, as you look at the image, the further away the objects are, the bigger the difference becomes between.
Yeah, that's right.
Once it gets too far away, so for instance, the other cactus in the background, which is too far away to view.
Well, there's a limit to what you can fuse anyway, but I mean that's depending on how much interocular you've got, and depending on where you've actually converged. Eventually, there will be an on-screen quite large divergence, but it will probably be way, way into the distance. You can't even see it, and it won't be a problem. But yeah, you're right. As these two lines that have crossed over and converged disappear into the distance, they get wider and wider. So that's all. That's a really good question, because that. If you do that in quite a condensed or from your foreground to your background object, that distance isn't too great, and you've put too much interocular in, you're going to have an on-screen divergence of something that is actually something you want to have a look at, because you've got too much of that, and it's a problem to fuse. So, but if it's way, way in the distance, a couple of miles away, doesn't matter, because you don't want to see it. Yeah, I've seen some techniques where there is that problem that's been in the scene that you would probably want to have some positive parallax. You'd want to fuse that image. They'll defocus that point, or use. Yeah, there are lots of tricks that can be used to.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Right, so NanoFlash 3D. Basically, all that is two. I don't know if anyone's used NanoFlash recorders. So it's an off-board recorder. I can record it up from a minimum of 50 megabits per second. That's two NanoFlash recorders bolted together, and it means that I'm going to get a fully synchronized left and right recording, one from each unit. I can turn them over with one remote control. I can feed them the same time code, and I'll get a perfect left and right eye copy. So real good bit of kit. And transvideo monitor. Yeah, so that's the monitor. It's a normal SDI monitor. It's an anaglyph monitor. It's currently got the left and right eye in it at the moment, or I can just use it as a normal SDI monitor. You know the figures that we were talking about earlier on of the percentage that were allowed in terms of on-screen parallax? I can use that monitor to set those pixel levels at my background parallax and my foreground parallax. So I can set the 3D depth well within the specification and know that I've set my 3D and it's not gone over what it should do. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's enough for the rig.
There's no way you can look through the viewfinder either code. You have to view through the monitor.
Well, you can.
If you're following.
Yeah. Yeah, you could do. Yeah, I mean, the only problem with doing that is you need to be 100% certain that view that they're both the same.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, I'm gonna go back over here. Sorry. Okay, we've seen the rig. Lens choice. Okay. So as we talked earlier on about roundness, wide-angle lenses are good for 3D. Use match lenses. Obviously, we want the picture on both camera to be exactly the same. So we can match lenses to a point, and there are various different ways of doing it, but they just need to be as good as they can get them. There are Ingenieux lens manufacturer are starting to provide or offer a 14 to 40-odd zoom lens. They're actually manufacturing them as a pair for 3D work, which is a first. So, avoid zoom lenses. There's a number of reasons for that. You can't zoom during a shot, and it's tied to the problem of lens optical centers not being matched when you zoom in. So you can avoid them. Can you zoom in post? That's a good question. You could zoom in, but then you would be effectively cropping the image and losing resolution. But you could do.
If you shot on a red or something like that.
Yeah, if you've got
the extra.
Yeah, if you've got the more res,
to zoom in on, but you probably wouldn't want to get too much on that.
Yeah, you can use a zoom lens. You just can't use it as a zoom lens. You can use it as a variable prime, but then you need to be sure that when you zoom that pair of lenses in with one remote to 100 mil or whatever. They're probably not both going to be at 100 mil. Or if they're at 100 mil, their optical centres are going to be off. So that's what these matched Ingenieux are about. Capture, so convergent design NanoFlash 3D, you've just seen there. One beyond Mini Wrangler. Some of the rigs that are out there are a user camera called SI2K. I don't know if you've heard of that. It's a small 2K data camera. And it's small and lightweight, so it's found quite a lot of favour, I think, with some of the smaller lightweight rigs. This is I don't know if you can get it as an optional video recorder, so an HDSDI recorder, but it's a data recorder. So it's got a built-in setup screen. You take an umbilical off each camera, come off the rig, get plugged into a recorder, and then it records onto one drive, a left and a right eye video stream, and it's also a setup unit as well, similar to this. This really, really nice piece of kit, if it works in SDI as well. SRW 5800, that's a Studio VT HDCam SR tape recorder. If you've got version 2, you can put left and right eye into the back of one VT, and it will record left and right eye onto one piece of SR tape. That's pretty good. Good idea to have a method transfer in rushes and create files for review while shooting. Monitors, Transvideo, Cine Monitors, is that one. Cinetronics, another manufacturer. JVC do some really nice 40-odd inch polar displays. May want to have a domestic 3D monitor on set, something like this, so that you can view. The bigger the monitor, you can look at 3D on, the better. You'll get the better effect, and you'll be able to see, things that you wouldn't normally see. It's not practical on some locations. Studio, it's fine. If you can't look at a big monitor during the day, you just have to make sure that you are reviewing your rushes every evening or whatever on a big monitor to avoid any mistakes. Bigger the better. That's just a list of post-production finishing systems. I wasn't really going to talk about them as such. Are they on the handout?
No.
They're all very top-end tools that you can. Mystica, for example, has got some really good 3D correction tools in it. I mean, that's what it's really been designed for. It's a grading tool as well, but it can you can do all sorts of things. You can correct color balances on cameras, geometrical problems, and so on. So, yeah, I think they're all good pieces of software. Tony, do you know much about our? Do you want to go back one? Have we explored any of our with the new coder?
I've seen some 3D on the new coder, but it was an Arbit.
Right, okay.
They've got a complete system. They use a Canon DSLR.
Right.
So they've got one camera, one lens, and you shift it and do that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So yeah. It's very, very good 3D.
Yeah.
And I've seen that and graded some of that on the new coder.
Right.
That's the new Pirates film.
Okay.
There are 3D tools in both.
Yeah. We've got films. We've got film like Baseline. We've got Digital Vision New Coder as well, so which is why I was...
You have to adjust the convergence of the slate with a crosshair in each
tape. All right, okay. Great, good. We've discussed that. Convergence adjustments. I mentioned earlier on that we don't... I may not have mentioned it here, but I mentioned it to a few people earlier on. We don't necessarily need to converge the cameras. We can, while we're shooting, we can just shoot parallel, and it's a technique that has been used quite successfully. And all it means is we just open the interocular up on the cameras, and we set them both ahead, straight ahead. The only downside to that from a location shooting point of view is you can't really see any 3D because everything disappears into the screen. Everything goes behind the screen plane in parallel. So if you want to be able to see 3D in that scenario, you won't be able to. But you could do that if you had a concern about where to converge and then converge in post later.
You then choose where it converges.
Yes. Yeah.
Is that how Jaws 3 or Jaws 3D would have been done?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. I think they probably... The rigs of this sophistication didn't exist. I don't know if they could even converge them. So, yeah, they probably got two film cameras and bolted them together as close as they could get them and then converged in post, yeah, probably. Retinal rivalry, ghost busting. I'm not going to go into those, John, in too much detail because I don't think we've got the time. But they're just... retinal rivalry and ghost, they're effects that we can get, some of the anomalies that we'll see. In fact, I will go into retinal. Have we got 10 minutes? Have I?
Yeah.
What? How much? Can we just spin forward and see if? Because I would like to talk about retinal rivalry if we can.
Yeah. Summary.
Great. Okay. Go back to that one, and I'll do that. Okay. So I'm not going to do floating windows. Okay. Retinal rivalry. So a couple of good examples of retinal rivalry are are you familiar with specular highlights? So if we're filming a surface that's got a puddle, water, a car windscreen, something with a texture, a tabletop that's been polished, depending on where the light hits that tabletop, it will create a reflection. And because there's a difference in the camera positions or eye positions, the view from one camera to the other of this reflection from this surface we're filming may be different. So it might be brighter, it might be a slightly different colour, it may bounce off in a different direction. And what happens, it doesn't happen live while we're looking at things because our brain can actually work it out. But where we've got two fixed camera positions, because there's a difference in width between one and the other, one of the eyes, it doesn't matter which one, may not even see this reflection at all, just because of the angle it's at. So when we play, when we put those two images together, one of our eyes is seeing a reflection and the other one isn't, and it looks odd. And our brain is telling us, well, that's a bit weird because my left eye can see it. Why can't my right eye? And that's a retinal rivalry, and it can you can get it in lots of different ways. So I guess the way that you would deal with retinal rivalry, if you had a highlight, is you'd kill the highlight so that both eyes don't see it, rather than try and go to the difficulty of trying to introduce an identical highlight on the surface. Sequined clothing is a really, really difficult one. You've got these tiny little mirrors, effectively, which is what a sequin is. Somebody walks past, or even if they're just sat there, and you're making a shot of them. One of the cameras isn't going to see the reflection in the same way as the other one is. So you'll see this reflected disc, but it won't have the impact because it's only in one eye. So you'd get rid of it. So that's a classic retinal rivalry. Ghost busting. Not going to go into that one. So to summarise, 3D, lots to think about. We hope today has given you a feel for the shape of things to come. Books. This is on your printout. I can thoroughly recommend this one. Not read this one yet, but it's on its way from Amazon. So this is a really good book. So get it, read it. It's about 25 quid. Really good. Don't know about that one. Questions? Of course you can.
about the active glasses.
Yeah.
How are they synchronised to the screen?
There's a sensor round about here, I believe, seems to...
Oh, is it infrared or something?
Yeah, it's infrared. So there's a... Can I have a pair? Thanks. So on the bridge, you can see that area there is basically a receiver. So you turn them on. This thing is basically showing alternate left and right eyes at a certain frequency. This is matched to the frequency when you turn them on, and it shuts one eye while the other eye is on and alternately. That's how they work, basically. Polarized glasses work in exactly the same way as do anaglyph glasses. Polarized glasses have just got... You're aware of how a polarized filter works. As you turn it in a certain direction, it will cut that amount of light. So they just orientate the filters in the glasses so that they're one's polarized in one direction, the other one in the other, and then that's the way they display it.
So are they switching it 25 hertz?
Don't know.
I think you have to, in order to use an active display, I think it's a minimum of 100.
Is it 100?
To get the refresh rate, so you don't notice it.
Yeah. Okay. Any more questions? Well, that's good. Does that mean we're all 3D basic experts then?
It's not for documentaries, is it, really?
It's not at the moment, but yeah, I mean, look what's happened in sort of 30 years in terms of technology. I mean, the problem for docs and that kind of thing, where you've got a lot of running around, they certainly can't take this thing. I don't know how long it's going to be, but ultimately we want to be able to pick up a camcorder, put it on our shoulder with one lens, and it's giving us a really good HD 3D image.
Yeah, there's a few rumours around that Sony are bringing out a good 3D camera in the not-too-distant future. Well, it's actually single lens, but it's split within the body. There's like a beam split within, and it does it within.
So that would be great.
It'd make it a lot easier, because then you don't have the whole issue of two lenses. You just
one lens.
Presumably then you can really easily change it into interocular distance by just changing how much
it is inside, it just splits accordingly.
Yeah. So there are some, obviously some serious challenges. Panasonic's attempt at that single camera is good, but it's not HD. It's got quarter inch sensors. Its data rate is 24 meg.
You've got to be 3 meters.
Yeah, we've got to be 3 meters. So you know it's quite a good attempt, I think, but it's it's not perfect by any stretch.
Good second camera.
Yeah, I mean what you're really asking is to put two full HD cameras in one body with all the controls that you need. So it's quite an ask, but that's the way technology advances. That's why we're making a good 3D today, I think. Is there any reason why I've got those? Yeah, there's a big issue with camera choice. Any camera that goes on the, or any 3D rig, has to have the ability to be gen-locked. So if it doesn't have gen-lock in, it's no good for a 3D rig. And so that's why I could have two X3s on there, but I've got, this one doesn't have gen-lock in, but I can get an HD output from it to gen-lock it to this one. And it's about time. And the basic reason you can't have a pair of cameras that aren't gen-locked is about timing. So if I've got two cameras and they're not perfectly sunk, a car drives past them or something goes past them, one of them may be seeing that image or printing that image slightly earlier than the other one, and then we've got a bit of a problem. So with gen-lock, I turn the cameras on, they are both frame perfect. Not really. The only reason I'm not bothered in this scenario, though they're different models, I know that the lens on both these cameras is identical. I know the lens centers are identical, so I don't really mind. I mean, ideally, when this rig's beefed up a little bit, I'll be able to put two reds on there, so that'll be quite good. So it needs, this rig will hopefully evolve into quite a good mirror rig. Yeah, well, there's a couple of things you could do. In that scenario, you might want to shoot parallel and lock the cameras together and not even worry about convergence. But adjusting camera convergence and interocular dynamically on the fly isn't a problem. Some of you familiar with Preston lens control systems or C-Motion wireless lens control systems? They're all adaptable now to be able to add a couple more axes. So you've probably got five axes in total. With this control, you can adjust the interocular. And with the dial on the side, you could adjust the convergence. That's the role of a 3D puller on a production. And that's really all they'll do. They will pull the 3D on the camera. So, yeah, that's doable. Absolutely, yeah, you could. I mean, take Cameron's approach, for example. He's already solved one of those problems by pulling convergence and focus at the same time. So it's probably asking the puller to do a bit too much. But, so it can be done. At the moment, to answer your question probably a bit better, if there are some quite small rigs, Element Technica make a rig called a freestyle rig, so it easily goes on the shoulder. Got hand grips, a couple of SI2Ks. There's cables coming out because it's going off to one of these One Beyond data recorders. And one of the rigs I've seen recently has actually got this monitor on a magic arm as a viewfinder, effectively. And that works quite well. You could do, yeah. I think I think what we should be looking at from an operator's point of view is not really worrying about, as long as the rig's right and the rig is sunk in every single area, what you really should be doing is thinking about just shooting it the way you would shoot something 2D. You don't need to look at two as an operator, you don't need to see two pictures at the same time. Is that what you meant, just in terms of... Yeah, I think the problem that you would have if you did that is you would put this. Imagine an operator with a pair of binoculars. He's going to have somebody who's going to tell him he's just about to trip over. So one technique, good handheld operators, not me, will employ is while they've got one eye glued to the viewfinder, they've also got their other eye, and they know, you know, they don't need somebody to tell them they're just about to walk into a lamppost. So. I think that would be the way I would tackle that.
Also, in terms of kind of workflow on set, do you know if it's kind of slowing things down a little bit in terms of playback rushes?
You can play back rushes, yeah. Mystica do a piece of software called Mystica Live, and they're constantly taking the feed out of the cameras, and they can combine it live and give you a live playback. Exactly.
So
that's one reason why you would have something like Mystic, because on any set worth its... Sorry?
It's probably a good idea, though, to... I mean, you can play back off the nano. Mm.
Yeah.
And obviously, if you're shooting for a mirror...
File-based is probably okay. I mean, file-based is okay. Tape is definitely not. If you're... If you attempted to play back some rushes once they're on the tape, you'd probably get your arm cut off, I think. But yeah, even with Firebase, I'm not sure I'd be that happy doing it Firebase. I'd be happy to make a copy of it, a live copy, which is what Mystica does, and play back that copy. Yeah, because you've got this. Once the rushes are in the can, you want to keep it in the can. So yeah. Any more questions? Yeah. Come on, must be something else.
What about 2D? If you want to get a 2D picture and shoot 3D at the same time, what's the best way of going about it?
Good question. Really good question. Thanks, Dave. So you're saying we're gonna shoot for 2D and get a 3D?
Well, you want a 3D, but you might get 2D. What would you do? Would you go with the 3D or do you go with the 2D? Which one is the one that you think of first?
Right. It's either way around, it's probably quite difficult, because one thing you're going to have to consider when you're writing your story and blocking out your scenes and whatever you're going to do is, because of, for various reasons, movement, things that don't work in shot, your script, your 3D script is going to be very different than your 2D script. So if you try and extract a 2D film from your 3D scripted film, it may look slightly different. I have been talking to some editors, and I think the timing from cuts seems to be slower. Was that about right?
Yeah, I mean,
hold
on.
Yeah.
Shots
fast,
a lot longer
In live action, fast cuts don't work with 3D. 3D animation is very different. They can pretty much do what they like. And fast cutting in, there are all sorts of things to consider. Because you, if you imagine you've... getting towards the end of a scene and you've pulled a really big IO towards the end of the scene, so there's a massive 3D depth in there for whatever reason. If the cut to the next scene has got a shallow depth of 3D depth in it, you can't just go from that one to the other one, because it's quite confusing. You need a little bit of time to get to that point. So there's certain tricks that you can use in terms of waiting for the right moment to do the cut and disguising your... depth change in the cut, but you do need to be really careful. So it's not, to answer your question, it's not that straightforward.
And
back
to direction is completely different.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. I wish I could say, from what I've seen, I wish I could say that it's a fairly similar way of working with 3D, but unfortunately it's not. So.
You see 3D films that are then...
Oh, what, see a 3D movie and then see it in 2D afterwards?
Well...
I mean, all that's going to do, it'll be the same film, it just won't have any depth.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously, you can shoot it in 3D and then...
Oh, of course, absolutely, yeah, you can do that, yeah. I mean, a lot of the animation I've been watching recently, if there's a challenging shot in 3D, they'll just go to 2D. You know, it just doesn't, you won't even notice... unless you take your glasses off. So, you know, there's this misconception about 3D that we have to use it as this eye-popping tool where, you know, everything comes out of the screen, or let's just use the 3D, let's just use it all the way through.
Well,
and it's... Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because it won't work in some shots, so just do it in 2D, nobody's going to notice. You'll be back on the 3D straight away. If it's a fast-paced piece, it doesn't matter. I think we've got to wrap it up there. One last question. Andy? One last question?
Yeah, one last question.
Great, thanks.
A good friend of mine, James, rang me yesterday saying he's going to be shooting Avatar 2 in 48 frames per second. You tried any different frame rates in the video and the way it looks, because apparently in 2D space, it just gives that very interlaced,
I haven't. No, I've heard that he is experimenting with that and changing the frame rate, and I think it's supposed to be a bit more comfortable.
Right.
But no, I have.
What do you mean, shooting wise, or for an eye?
For the eye.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
We got time for one more. Literally, this is the last one. One more question.
Can I ask another?
Or not. Yeah, of course you can.
Left and right eye.
Yeah.
Obviously, right eye fixed. Left eye moving.
On this rig, yeah.
Is that standard throughout all rigs, or does it not matter?
No, good question. Right. This one's fixed. This one does all the work, convergence, interocular. If I wanted to use this on a Steadicam rig, so the point of Steadicam rig, it has to be precisely to the gram balance point measured. So if I've put this rig on a Steadicam and then my 3D puller ramps the eye open all of a sudden and this camera comes flying out this way, Steadicam's going to tilt. So in that scenario, I'll use the Element Technica Freestyle rig that has both of the cameras would do the IO, so they'd move half as much, but they would oppose, and that way you don't get a balance issue because they're.
But there is no hard and fast rule then for left right eye, which moves, which doesn't.
Does it matter? Convergence, it doesn't matter.
Right.
I guess not. No, yeah. Not really. No.
I think often if you've got 2D in mind, you might frame a shot with
that's a good point.
Eye.
Yeah.
So use your left eye as your main eye, and then see if that's moving around. That's not
of course.
Great for your
absolutely
2D
yeah
version.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah. It is, yeah. There's a bit of a joke going around. It's about 1% or something like that. And the loudest opponents to 3D in the business that carry some weight can't actually see it. So I don't know if that's true or not. But there is. There's some people just can't get it. And it's probably, there's a biological reason for that probably. All our eyes are slightly different. I think there are some things, I don't know exactly what they are, some eye defects aren't good for 3D, but don't ask me which way. So.
And on that note, I'm going to have to sort of say thanks very much to Phil. I'm sorry to cut you short. Thanks very much to Gordon, Dave, Jamie, and the rest of the film's team. Seriously, thank you very much. Fascinating. Thank you very much indeed for your time.